Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne in West London.
Hello, it's Richard Heller in South East London.
And we got a really remarkable guest today, Richard. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about him before we introduce him.
Indeed. He's a cricket lover, but he's also one of the leading human rights lawyers in the world. Clive Stafford Smith is the founder of the Reprieve organisation, which specialises in defending people facing execution and of people and victims of rendition and torture, extrajudicial imprisonment and killing in the name of counter-terrorism. He's won many international honours, including a British OBE and a Gandhi Peace Award. As a lawyer practiced in the southern United States, he personally represented over 300 prisoners facing the death penalty. All but six of them were spared. He took five cases to the pre-Trump Supreme Court, all of them successfully. With other lawyers, he fought successfully to represent inmates detained without charge at Guantanamo Bay. He secured the release of 80, including all the British ones. There's still seven there. And as if that weren't enough, he's now fighting another very fierce battle to save his local cricket club, which we're going to talk about later. Welcome, Clive. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad we got to the serious stuff at the end there, Richard.
Yeah, Clive and I have played quite a lot of cricket together. He plays for this lovely club in Dorset, but we've also toured Pakistan and things like that. We'll talk about it. And so it's really lovely to get Clive on with his very rich cricketing as well as human rights heritage. But Clive, you've actually played cricket, not just in Dorset and in Sagoda University and places like that on our wonderful tour, but you've actually played cricket at Guantanamo Bay, haven't you?
I certainly have. There isn't any more, sad to say, because it's very tough on the Jamaicans who work there. But I've been there 40 times, and there was a group of Jamaicans who, for many years, I've been going there 17 years, would play cricket. It was the most extraordinary thing to watch and to take part in, because it was always like 110 degrees, and there was not a single member of the Jamaican squads there who didn't come off at least a 40-pace run-up. They all wanted to be Michael Holding. And they wouldn't use umpires. You had to call your own LBW, which as a bowler, I think is a dream. But it was fantastic stuff. I love those guys. I used to take them cricket gear in my luggage. It was always interesting coming through the searches of the US military because it was full of pads and bats and things. And they didn't know quite what to make of it.
Guantanamo Bay, it took me a long time before I worked out actually where it was. It's a little island, isn't it, off the coast of Cuba?
Well, it's actually on Cuba. Yeah. It's a big bay. Actually, April the 30th, 1494, Christopher Columbus sailed in there and took one look and left. He certainly didn't think it was El Dorado. And there's the people who work there, who are not the American military, are either Filipino or Jamaican. And it's a very tough life for them, and it used to give me such pleasure to hang out with them while they played cricket, because they brought all that wonderful joie de vivre of West Indian cricket to the bay. And I wrote a piece about it for what they call the MWR, the Morale, Welfare and Recreation magazine of the military, but they wouldn't publish it. They really didn't get what the game was all about.
Well, it seems to me that piece ought to be published somewhere.
I've still got it. I will gladly ship it to you, Peter. I wish they got the credit that was their due, because it was lovely to watch.
These are Jamaican. Are they guards or cooks or what are they?
No, they're people. I mean, it is shocking, actually. The folk who come to make more money than they perhaps could in Jamaica. But many aspects of the law don't apply in Guantanamo, as you well know. Including the minimum wage. And these guys would work long days and they would be paid $13.65 for the whole day. And actually, if they had to pay for the breakfast, lunch and dinner at the place, they would come out 50 cents behind on the day. So, you know, they were working under terrible conditions. And one of the things I tried to do while I was there was get them paid properly, but that hasn't worked.
I don't imagine they had trade union rights, the Jamaicans and Filipinos, did they?
They certainly didn't. And I had, there was one of the ACLU, American Civil Liberties lawyers, came down with me at one point, and he tried to do that, and he got summarily kicked off the base for daring to introduce trade union rights to Guantanamo.
Legally, I think I'm right, Guantanamo Bay still belongs to Cuba, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
I mean, it's never belonged anywhere else, isn't it? It's an American lease, I think.
It's right, and ever since 1899. And indeed, that's the pretext on which the US argued that the prisoners had no rights at all. And we did argue in the US Supreme Court that the iguanas have rights because the environmental laws apply there. So if I, as an American, kick an iguana, I get 10 years in prison. But if I kick Peter, who's just British, I don't get anything at all. So we argued for equal rights with iguanas for our prisoner.
Some of the inmates of Guantanamo, I think you've said, were interested in cricket, were players or devotees of cricket. Did they get any sort of opportunity to play or practice it within Guantanamo or simply to follow it?
No, the only thing they get is the opportunity, sadly, to have to put up with me talking to them about it. There are lots of people, actually. There's a bunch of Pakistanis. Of my seven remaining clients, three are Pakistani, all of whom are devotees. And then, you know, one of my favorite clients is Asadullah Haroon, who's the very last Afghan, and he's totally nobody, but he is from Afghanistan. And, of course, he grew up in those Peshawar camps where the Afghans have taken up cricket.
These were the refugee camps in the northern Pakistan where they come across the border, is that right?
Exactly. And yeah. I was in Kabul just before all of this pandemic stuff with someone who was being incredibly helpful with me negotiating this poor chap's release, who has just sent me a note saying that he's buying one of the first Afghan, you know, it's not IPL, but APL, teams to do the equivalent in Afghanistan. And what a great idea. And I do think we need to go on our next tour to Afghanistan there, Peter.
This is the birth of a great idea.
It's on our bucket list, yes.
Yeah, we get definitely. I love that idea. So there's going to be, what you've just said, there's going to be an Afghan Premier League.
There is. And, you know, when you think about it, I think this is very seriously true, and it's what motivated me to be so keen on coming on your tour to Pakistan, Peter, is that, you know, sport is ritualized warfare, and there's really nothing quite like cricket. You know, if you think about the great generals of history, you know, you would include Napoleon and various other people like that, but you'd also include great captains of cricket. And if you, the main thing,
Jardine being the most formidable, yes.
Yeah. Well, there are one or two who perhaps tried to turn cricket into warfare instead of warfare into cricket. But if we can get, and I've talked to Imran Khan about this, if we can just get the India and Pakistan, for example, over Kashmir to have a cricket game instead of kill each other in a war, it's just a much, much better way to go. And I love the fact that the Taliban and, you know, other people in Afghanistan are potentially going to start playing cricket. And maybe that's the route to peace instead of some of the other things we've done.
Well, quite a lot of Indian and, of course, Pakistani leaders have tried sort of cricket diplomacy. And there's been periods where there's been a thaw, certainly between India and Pakistan over the cricket field, long periods. Unfortunately, there's now a deep freeze over their relations, both in cricket and other ways.
But it's worth trying, though. I mean, I was talking to someone that Peter certainly knows, Shahzad Akbar, who is an old colleague of mine as a human rights lawyer. And Shahzad
had a reprieve in Pakistan, wasn't he, Shahzad, for a long time?
Well, he still is. It's the Foundation for Fundamental Rights that we helped found. And Shahzad and I were talking about taking a team of lawyers to India to do that. And, you know, I think it'd be great if he was able to do it. He's now one of Imran Khan's ministers, so I'm not sure he'd be allowed to. But, you know, that's the sort of thing we need to do to show goodwill.
He's also a decent off-spinner, Shahzad, and quite a dicey lower-middle-order batsman.
If he hits the ball, it goes a long way. But it's quite a big if sometimes, but if he does, he connects.
I think this is so exciting, though, what this subject, what has happened with cricket. The Taliban have cricket teams in northwest Pakistan. They had, you know, there would be tournaments with local security, with Pakistan state security and the Taliban playing at the height of the war and in those areas. And of course, they've clearly smiled on cricket in Afghanistan. And I was told when I was researching this in Peshawar that, you know, when Pakistan plays, the Taliban would lay down its arms, bring in a generator and put on a television and watch the national team play. It's one of those amazing things that cricket can unite a nation.
Oh, you're so right. I mean, look, I've brought the very first case in Guantanamo way back when. So, you know, rightly or wrongly, I do tend to get credit from the people who got out for it. And so there are 206 Afghans who we've ended up representing, and many of them, you know, alleged members of the Taliban. And I'm in touch with them all the time because we're negotiating to try to help get the last people home. And they're incredibly friendly. And it is such a level at which you can establish rapport to talk about cricket. And isn't it amazing to watch how Afghanistan has come along in the last few years? I mean, goodness knows, I want to recruit some of them for my Dorset cricket team.
Incredibly exciting. Yeah. There's the Afghan diaspora, which we've been learning about in these podcasts, where Afghans have gone to Germany now. So they picked up the cricket, first of all, in the camps you were talking about in North Pakistan during the war. And then they've gone back to Pakistan and gone on to Germany. And there are now 370 cricket teams in Germany.
Wow. And, you know, there's one, of course, in Calais. And I was talking to some folk last
year. There's one in the in the camps in Calais.
In the camps. And look, you know, they get a bad rap sometimes from politicians, the people in Calais, but obviously a lot of them are coming from dire, dire straits. And I was talking to some folk about taking a team over there, but I just think that's a wonderful aspect of goodwill.
Let's do that. Let's do that. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, that's a lot easier than going all the way to Afghanistan. But you've got to promise me, Peter, we're going to go to Kabul and play in Kandahar.
Kandahar and Kabul. We will do that. No, but going back, so you have six Pakistanis you're trying to extricate from Guantanamo at the moment, did you say?
Well, there are three. I've got seven clients left. There are 40 people left in Guantanamo, only 40 out of 780. And three of those are Pakistanis and one is an Afghan.
And so when you go in, have they got the ability to find out the latest scores, cricket scores? Do you bring them in? But you fill it in between talking about legal details,
my legal letters sometimes almost as bad as the ones I used to write to my dear mother from school, which all had very little in them except for my cricket town scores. So yeah, that I talk to them about that, but you know, no, they don't get to watch it. More's the pity. They don't get to hear it. You know, they're very much stuck in those dreadful cells in Guantanamo.
Are their communications censored? Do they wonder if they, you know, the guards and security wonder what all of these cricket messages are and if code? Yeah.
Richard, there are such bizarre things in the censorship process, and you'll recognise that one of the problems is that the US military over the years has censored numbers for reasons that are totally beyond me. I mean, if you were to write as the daughter of one of these guys and say, I just had my 12th birthday, that would get censored, which obviously makes it a bit difficult for non-lawyers. I mean, what I write doesn't get censored, but for non-lawyers, you know, if you send them the cricket scores, all the numbers get wiped out. So that rather ruins the point, doesn't it?
So it's fascinating how cricket is peripherally involved, but in an odd way, quite central to your work, getting people out of Guantanamo. And the same would be true of your immensely important work trying to stop drone attacks in the Northwest Front, what we used to call the British did the Northwest Frontier.
Well, it's very true. That's a horrific thing where we as Americans have used Hellfire missiles fired from Predator drones to assassinate people in ways that were declared illegal in 1758. And You know, one of my big problems with that was the US has this war going on where no Americans are actually anywhere close. They're controlling their drones from Nevada. And they get such amazingly bad intelligence from informants who they're paying money that, you know, they tried to assassinate Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was, you know, second in command of al-Qaeda, and they've never got him in 20 years, but they've killed 56 children doing it. So
I guess I'll say that again, that Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is actually now the head of al-Qaeda, isn't he?
Right.
After bin Laden.
So they targeted him. He's not been killed. He's been targeted. And the trouble is,
56 children have been killed by drones, which have been
targeting him. Yeah, because they get the wrong intelligence, right? And my problem as an American is both that I think this is immoral, but it's also really bad for American PR, because we were becoming the most hated nation on earth. So I had got together with Imran when he was in opposition, and I have the greatest respect for Imran Khan. I'm very upset that he refuses to play for my Dorset cricket team, because I did invite him at one point, and he smiled and said, having captained a World Cup winning team, I think it would be a bit of a come down, which obviously you and I understand is terribly insulting to the Marauders.
What is the name of your team in Dorset?
I got two, actually, but there's the Mafferton Marauders and the Broadwinds Cricket Club.
And so you've been snubbed by the Prime Minister of Pakistan.
It is shocking. And by the captain of Pakistan. I think that's horrific.
His fate is sealed.
I know. Well, we probably ought to drone poor old Imran for that insult, shouldn't we? But he was fantastic on this. And you'll appreciate this, that we went on a rally into Waziristan to try to illustrate what was happening to all these poor folk. And Imran told me on the way, he said, I'm Pashtun and I'm going to take you to the graves where I can show you where my ancestors killed your ancestors. but it was really fantastic. And the work that he did, you know, I can do what I do, but he's a superstar, right? And so, you know, if we would hold a press conference together as we did, I think I would get quoted by 1% of the media and Imran would get quoted by 98%, which is wonderful. And with his work, which was very courageous at the time for a politician to take on something like that, you know, we got it down from 200 drone strikes a year almost, which were killing hundreds of people, to, as of 2019, zero. Which is a fantastic step forward.
And this year, what has the figure been this year? Clive?
Zero again this year. So they haven't.
So under Imran's leadership, Pakistan, they've stopped the drone strikes.
Well, but I mean, more to the point, they almost stopped it before he was elected.
That was
thanks to his work, and thanks to the work we all did to expose it. And indeed, Shahzad Akbar, who we played cricket with, because Shahzad, as a lawyer, and I brought a case where the court in Peshawar ruled it illegal and ordered the Pakistan government to stop it. So, you know, that was all fantastic, and it was all thanks to Imran Khan, who I think, you know, I talked to him, and he very much discusses working with his cabinet in the work he's doing now as Prime Minister. He compares it to captaining a team, and I think that's right. I think that's what he's trying to do is exactly the same thing. But he also does say, and he told me this when we were having dinner in New York recently, that he genuinely thinks there'll be a nuclear exchange in Kashmir because it's going to, yeah. And so, you know, this is one of the concerns where I think we all need to take very seriously the need to find more peaceful ways, including what we discussed in terms of cricket as ritualized warfare instead of real warfare, to try to lower the temperature between India and Pakistan. Because you know what it's like. The Indians and the Pakistanis love each other's cricketers. And if we can just get all of them involved, that'll help stop something far worse.
Yes, as you know, Richard and I have written an awful lot about, had the honour of writing an awful lot about Indian and Pakistan cricket. And one of the things we've learnt is that when the two nations, great nations, play, the actual ordinary people are thrilled. And there's no, when Indians go to Pakistan, they're welcomed, vice versa. That, you know, there is a genuine warmth about it. And it's a very narrow sort of sphere of the military political elite which maintain this hostility.
Religious elite as well, sometimes.
Well, it does make you think about the recent news about the English going on tour there, and I do hope we do, because I think it's more than just India and Pakistan, isn't it? I mean, if any countries want to mediate to try to keep everyone a bit calmer, then they need to be involved. And again, ironically, I think actually sending a cricket team to Pakistan and then hopefully to India is a form of mediating that I think is overwhelmingly important, as well as we want them to play cricket, don't we?
As you know, we play cricket in Free Kashmir, Azad Kashmir. And I was very shocked, actually, playing there, to learn that there was shelling all the time across from India, and I don't know what was going back the other way. Villagers being killed, you know, there was a constant near state or semi-warfare. But what I hadn't realised, and what really kind of took me back there, was that Imran Khan is afraid of a nuclear confrontation. How do we get from this low-level conflict at the moment, which is quite severe and with lots of national pride at stake, to actually a nuclear, because they're both nuclear powers, of course, India and Pakistan.
This is how it works. And actually, when I had that conversation with Imran, the very next day I was talking to someone about American wargaming, who confirmed that over the last 40 years and all the wargaming they've done, the only one that always comes out as a nuclear exchange is this. And it works like this, unfortunately. You know, we're seeing far too much Hindu nationalism in India, it seems to me, at the moment. And, you know, all of these nationalistic things tend to be about hating the other. You look at India, and it's only going to be 20 years, and India will be the country with the biggest Muslim population of any country in the world. And so, but they're a minority in India, and they're being repressed by some of this nationalism. And what's inevitably going to happen, because we've seen it happen all around, is some mad young men will do some crazy thing, as they already have in past years, and blow themselves up. Then the Indian government will blame the Pakistan government and will say, we got to retaliate, and they're going to bomb some part of Pakistan. Imran, sitting there trying to avoid at all costs a military exchange, as he did when he let that pilot go.
He behaved very responsibly, very early stage of his national leadership. That was in February last year, wasn't it? And yeah. Imran straight away handed back the pilot after he'd been shot down. He defused the whole situation. He behaved with remarkable statesmanship, right. I felt.
And he did. And he really wants to do that. But he says, look, there's only a limit of what I can do. If they start bombing Pakistan, you know, in the end, it's going to be very hard to stop us from bombing them back. This then escalates. Pakistan is much the smaller partner in this exchange. And he reckons that Pakistan will be forced in a position where they'd be the one who'd be the first ones to push the button. Now, you know, he desperately wants to avoid that, and he and I have talked in various ways that we can try to help ameliorate that in what small way I can contribute. But I think that's something we need to be very, very clear on. This is a real looming problem, which is why anything we can do. And I keep coming back to this cricket business. But, you know, we played in that lovely pitch. You remember that one, Peter, with the golden domes on the places that were our changing rooms? And that was very close
just
to
outside that lovely place just outside on the road from Lahore to the Indian border.
I do remember going to collect the fours, and there were those thorny bushes along the edge that would just rip you to shreds. But, you know, that was very close to the border, and that was where the shelling was happening. And, you know, we got to do things, you know, we got to have peaceful games of cricket, peace concerts, peace whatever that we can do to try to make sure that this doesn't happen. I think it's much more dangerous than anything that's going on between the US and Russia or China.
Well, talking of China, what would China do in a in an Indian-Pakistanic nuclear exchange. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I've reached out a bit to the Chinese through an intermediary because I think that's important. And, you know, right now, of course, China and India are more hostile than India and Pakistan. So the Chinese, you know, are very difficult to predict under these circumstances. And I'm not sure we can challenge them to a cricket match. But, you know, it's hard to say where they're going to come down. Because as you're indicating, they've got one of the three areas of Kashmir. So it's not just a bipartite thing, it's tripartite.
Clive, recently you testified on behalf of Julian Assange fighting extradition to the United States. Can you tell us a bit about, about your testimony and about those extraordinary proceedings?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, the issue is what would happen to Julian if he went to the US. And it is an incredibly important case because we take free speech very seriously in the US with the First Amendment. And he would be the first person ever who would be criminally prosecuted for receiving leaks of information, as opposed to leaking it himself. And my testimony was really about how the leaks that he got and then put out was responsible for us learning all sorts of extraordinary things about criminal acts like an assassination list on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border that NATO had for going around murdering people in ways that are utterly illegal. And that was leaked through WikiLeaks, and we would never have known it otherwise. So that, you know, my testimony was just about how whistleblowers actually play an important role in our society to reveal criminality. We didn't, sadly, get into his cricketing career, which I learned from your podcast included his invitation to go play in Quito. But I shall ask him about that next time I have a chance.
I think he did accept. I think he's actually accepted membership of the Quito Cricket Club. So one hopes he'll have an opportunity to enjoy the benefits.
I'd say we played a small role in that, Richard, because when we read the Wisden report that Quito had offered him membership and written to him in Belmarsh offering him membership, I approached Deepa Driver, who's one of his sort of team, I think, and she got in touch with him, and he said he'd never received the invitation. But then we heard from his team that he was very happy to accept it. So we passed back to Quito that information that he's honoured to be a member of the cricket club.
Well, I think we need to know, you know, where his talent lies with batting and bowling. I shall find that out so that on our next tour of that goes to the Andes Mountains that he can come
yes,
and play.
Yes, we haven't done a South American tour yet. If, inshallah, Julian Assange is freed from Belmarsh, would he be a player you'd welcome in your Broad Windsor cricket team down there in Dorset, Clive?
I'm sure we would. We would. There's not a bad team, Broad Windsor. But of course, we've got to ensure that the cricket team still exists at the time we finally get poor old Julian out of Belmarsh.
So tell us about this campaign. I mean, you've extracted so many hundreds of people from Guantanamo and saved them from execution, but this really is your final sort of campaign of your illustrious career to save your local cricket club. Tell me, because actually it's a universal theme in Britain at the moment, the closure and threats of extinction to local clubs. Tell us what's happening with yours.
Well, let me first say, Peter, I slightly resent the idea this is my last campaign. I'm feeling pretty good.
I'm sure there's going to be more. Yeah.
I had a good season this year. Got the first
many more overs. Yeah.
My first hat trick for 43 years. Anyway,
golly.
So unfortunately, Zach Crawley ruined it because he got 267 on the same day. So I lost Cricketer of the Week. What's happening with Broad Windsor is one of these very sad things, that over the last 2 years here in this part of Dorset, we've lost two lovely grounds, one in Bridport, one in Melflash. And Broad Windsor, where I play most of my cricket, is a gorgeous ground. In 2007, Wisden voted it one of the five most beautiful grounds in England. And it is lovely. And, you know, my favourite thing about the ground actually is there's an old people's home just next door. And they sent us a letter saying, please would we trim the hedge down so that the old people there could watch our cricket matches, which I think is just lovely. But unfortunately, the incredibly benevolent people who had rented us the ground for 60 years, and our club is 97 years old, so we're three short of a century. The benevolent owners had passed on and had left it to some people who don't have the same interest, who served us with an eviction notice. And it was all a bit fraught. And I will say that I'm used to doing battle with governments. And so, you know, I probably took slightly the same approach to this. But we've negotiated them down. They wanted like a huge amount of money for it, but I think we've got them down about £100,000 to £35,000, which is a reasonable price for this pitch. And we got to raise the money to save it, and we got to do that, obviously. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And to lose these grounds, particularly when instead of losing them, we want to expand them. And what I really want is to get more youth and women. There are 35 girl guides in Broad Windsor who want to learn cricket. And I think bringing, you see these amazing things with the women's team nationally, but I'm not convinced that in our part of the world, women's cricket is coming along nearly fast enough. So, you know, there's so many plans we'd like to do, but first we've got to rescue this pitch. So we've been doing a crowdfunder campaign. Crowdfunders based here in Bridport in large part, and they've been great. And we got a Sport England matching grant. So we're doing well. We've got up to about 27,000 so far.
How can our listeners, can you just explain in very simple, slow language how anybody listening can donate?
Well, it would be incredibly kind if people were to go to our website, Broad Windsor Cricket Club, or to the crowdfunder website where you can just look it up and donate. And I've spread it around a bit. For my American friends who don't really get the game, we're giving them honorary titles such as honorary silly mid-on and honorary square leg, which I think appeal. We give them certificates they can put up on their office walls, which I think appeals a bit to the US because, you know, and look, I've tried to explain the rules to baseball players many times, and we finally agreed that the big difference between cricket and baseball is we serve better beer at cricket matches. That's about as far as you get. But I think with this, if people are willing to make donations, that would be fantastic. And then hopefully we'll put it in a trust that'll be eternally cricket and you know, we'll thrive for the next 97 years, I hope.
Clive, I have a confused memory that you can get land that's been used for recreation for a long time registered as common land. Is that an avenue you've looked at?
You know, we did, and I did legal research, and, you know, this is not quite my field, but I know my way around a law book, and if we wanted to, we could be really quite aggressive about this. But, you know, the law is not a great way to solve anything, right? So you've got war, you've got law, and then you've got cricket, and I'd rather solve it under the rules of cricket if we can possibly do that, and I hope we will be able to.
I mean, speaking as somebody coming to this new, I tend to take a very dim view of the new owners of your cricket ground. I mean, it's a great, being a landowner is something which carries with it enormous responsibility. You know, it shouldn't be private. It should be something which everybody enjoys. And to stop a local cricket club using a cricket field they've been using for 60 years seems to me to be reflect very badly indeed on the people who have inherited this land.
Well, I tend to agree, although I'm trying to be nice here. And there was you, Peter, were the one who was kind enough to get Henry Blofeld to support our campaign.
Oh, has he? He's come on board, has he?
It was great. And, you know, Blo has sent a letter. And I kind of edited it down a teeny bit because he put it in such strong terms. I didn't want to offend everybody. I mean, I agree with his sentiments absolutely, but you know, he wrote about how people don't, you know, they know about monetary value but not about true value, and I think that's true, isn't it? I mean, this is a gem of the community. And if we're going to carry on having our sport thrive, then we've got to have these local grounds that young people can learn on, and then go on to, you know, just near here, we were the one, we've given you many a fine cricketer.
Well, maybe we should, Richard and I, both of us are associated with teams in, we should take a team down and have a little bit of a fundraising match next summer.
Well, I think, if are you both on the same pitch, same team or different teams?
Either or both. We've played with them against each other.
Well, because you should bring two teams down. We'll have a triumvirate. I love those triangular games where we play over a weekend. You know, we can play.
Lovely idea.
Yeah, it'd be really nice. And the captain of my team, A.D. Phillips, who's been captain since he was 18, and I think he'll forgive me if I say he had his 56th birthday last week. He's also the publican of our local pub, so we can promise you a good time. So.
Well, I think that's a great... Richard is the team is called the Erratics, by name and by nature. and my team is called the White City All-Stars. We'll all descend into West Dorset one weekend next year, and we'll raise some money for the appeal.
Excellent. Well, you can just come and have a good time too. We'd love you, and other clubs around the country are utterly welcome all the time.
Now, Horningsham is the other club, and they're very keen. They sent Callum, the captain, has sent a message that he's really keen to play you.
Now, can I ask you though, Peter, the White City All-Stars, I mean, are you one of the stars there? I'm very impressed.
Yes, I am indeed. Yeah. We've got more distinguished players.
I'd like to go back to Radley, since it's a famous, you know, where you learnt some of your cricket, Clive, which is a very famous cricket school. You went to Radley, and I think at that time your warden was Dennis Silk. He became a big power in English cricket, been a future president of the MCC and chair of the Test and County Cricket Board. I think he made you head boy. So I just wondered what memories you had of him.
Oh, look, actually, Dennis was the most wonderful person. Dennis and I didn't quite see eye to eye politically, but he was one of the people I respect immensely. And I've seen a lot of him up until his death just some months ago over the years. He's always come down every year. I play for a team, the Earl of Sandwich's team, down here once a year. And Dennis would come down and umpire. And he was the most fair person in the world, right? And a stickler for fairness. But I'm going to tell you a secret that'll probably tar the poor man's name. That when he came here and I was the only old boy of his school, he used to give me LBWs that I'm not sure I deserved, and that was a fine sign, I think. But he was a wonderful man.
You were an opening bowler for Radley, weren't you?
I was indeed.
And you appear in Wisden in your year as a 17-year-old, was it?
I was 17, yeah.
And it's quite nice figures.
Pretty tasty figures, I see quoted here.
They weren't bad. And look, I do sometimes say to people that I am at least 44 years past my bowling prime at this point. And I say that because actually, to be honest, I should be a member of the Erratics these days. But back in those days, you know how they say about sports people that if you want to get really good, you've got to put 10,000 hours into practicing. And you think about people like Don Bradman, who would practice, you know, hitting a ball on a stick. You know, you just had to do that. And I was so desperate to get into the Radley First 11 that I was up every morning at 6 a.m. for 2 years going down in the pouring rain to lift weights, to try to do something about this paltry body of mine so I could get into the team. I loved it. I loved playing cricket for Radley. And my enduring misery was I had to take a physics A level on the day that the young Australians came to play us. And they wouldn't let me rearrange the exam. I'd do it anytime. I'd do it in the middle of the night. I don't care when. If I could just have played against them. And I was so upset that I couldn't do that.
Clive, what's remarkable about your school career, your career as a school cricketer, is I think you were having a great battle with bulimia at the time, which is a condition that I think wasn't at all understood in the 1970s.
I don't think it's understood very well today. And I was so touched watching the hour-long documentary that Freddie Flintoff did the other day about his own struggle with bulimia. Now, obviously, I could only dream of being mentioned in the same breath as Freddie. But it was wonderful to see, you know, he's also got such a lovely smile, old Freddie, and the way he would talk about it was great. And it made me want to join him in my own small way to help advertise what he went through, because I did too. And, you know, when I was trying to become, you know, a famous cricketer at my school, I was the same height I am now, which is a little over 6'3", but I was 70 pounds lighter. And, you know, Peter will say I'm not exactly anything more than skinny today. And so I looked like, back then there was the whole Biafran thing where those poor people were starving there, and I looked like that because I was bulimic. And I'd sort of got it because my mother and my sister were very obsessed with food and constantly on a diet, and it made me, you know, very paranoid about it. And I suffered from that from age 16 to 22, and it was awful. And, you know, you just imagine when you're training, being just not eating and being so skinny, it's really bad for you. And no one even noticed, let alone would believe it, because it just was never considered that men suffered from that. And this is just what Freddie's saying in his brilliant, brilliant piece. And I think it's important for us to talk about it, because it's still not recognized among men. It's more recognized among women. And I think we need to keep our eyes open for people who are suffering from it today. So I hope, in my small way, you know, just by mentioning it too, that that I can encourage other people to talk more about these things, because it was very dangerous. And I was really lucky to get out of my obsession with calories and food by becoming utterly obsessed with the death penalty and representing people on that. And I just didn't have time to think about other things then. But it was a very dangerous physical moment in my life, I think.
You went to the United States, I think, after you left school, in preference to going to university here, and you practiced law in the United States, but you also played a lot of cricket, especially, I think, in Atlanta. And you shared, you played on the same team as quite a few great West Indian cricketers, particularly Conrad Hunt. Conrad Hunt was, I think, Barbadian consul there. So tell us about him, and I imagine he was a pretty formidable player even then.
I was playing with Conrad's team, which was the MCC. That's great. It's the Metropolitan Cricket Club. He named it that. And I played with him for 9 years in Atlanta when I was doing death penalty work. He was one of the world's most delightful gentlemen. There were a lot of West Indians came to Atlanta. He was there because his wife was a television presenter there. And he was in his early 60s. At the time, amazingly fit, amazingly kind. You know, the fact that someone who had batted with Sir Garfield Sobers in that famous game where Gary Sobers made 365, and in that same game, Conrad made a double century. And
as a fans of Pakistan cricket, we find this a sensitive and difficult subject, Clive.
It was against a three-man attack. But the runs had to be made.
The runs did, and they made a lot of runs. And Conrad was so lovely. And, you know, my team, I opened the bowling for that. And Conrad had to put up with people like us, having played with people like that. And he was always so kind. He kept wicket on our team and opened the batting. And he'd keep wicket, and if he decided we were so bad. You know, I remember one game, there was another team in Atlanta that had three West Indian former internationals, and we used to play them. And I always relished that, because the idea of getting a scalp of one of them was such a great thing. It was on these matting wickets, and so you already just had a chance because there were some pretty lumpy parts of the wickets. And I remember Desmond Lewis, who lived in Atlanta at the time and who played briefly for the West Indies, was opening the batting against us, and I opened the bowling. And very first ball, he hit a catch back to me, which wasn't that difficult. And I don't know about you, but I remember every catch I've ever dropped off my own bowling. And there's only about three, but you just don't do that, do you? And I dropped him. I dropped him first ball, and he went on to score an enormous. If he didn't get these guys out early, it was hopeless. And he scored a lot of runs against us. And it was so, you know, in those games, Conrad would watch growing despair at the rest of us. And then every now and then he'd pull off his pads and gloves and he'd bowl to try to make up for our inadequacies. And it was, he was such a nice guy. It was fantastic.
No, he's very well... Gary Richard appeared on Mastermind with his special subject, Gary Sobers, and so he knows. But in Sobers' autobiography, he speaks so warmly of Conrad Hunt as being such a decent, honest, kind man.
Well, it's so true. And he went on to South Africa to coach cricket down there and then sadly passed away too young. Well, not old enough. But he was. I always love to meet famous people who turn out to just be incredibly nice. Because it's heartwarming, isn't it? Sometimes it's not true.
Yeah. But Sobers was saying, you know, for instance, he always walked. He was completely straight. You know, not no games. You know, no cheating. Absolutely immaculate. And of course, he then joined Moral Rearmament, didn't he? He was a very moral man.
He certainly had a great faith himself. And, you know, the thing about it was he loved his cricket. You know, he loved his cricket so much that he would take a group of people like us. One of the players on my team was an American who was, I won't name him because he was frankly the worst cricketer I've ever come across. But he was so keen and he knew every statistic of every game going back to about 1850. And Conrad was
man
just...
Man after my own heart. Yeah.
There you go. No, but actually, Peter, I will say in your defense that as an all-star of White City, you're much better as a player than this guy. But Conrad was just such a gent. You know, every catch this guy would drop and every time he'd get out for naught. Conrad was just always encouraging and kind, and I just thought that spoke so well of the man.
A lot of West Indian influence on American cricket, isn't there, Clive? Mainly from emigration, and apart from those you played with, there have been quite a few others. West Indian cricketers have fetched up in America. Alf Valentine was one. Alf Valentine had a long sort of second life in Florida, where, among other things, he became a serial foster parent. He fostered, he and his wife... fostered dozens of disadvantaged kids. George Headley nearly became an American dentist. If it hadn't been for his immigration papers getting mixed up, that would have been his path in life.
That would have been a great disaster, wouldn't it, for West Indian cricket if he'd gone off and became an American.
But if anything, the influence is the other way now, isn't it? It's rather than West Indians influencing American sport, it's Americans influencing course of West Indian sport and sort of squeezing out cricket, isn't it? Or at least that's
well, there is a lot of that. I mean, I will say that all down the eastern seaboard, I think cricket is still fairly healthy. When I went to Columbia Law School in New York and I used to play there in Van Cortlandt Park, and there was a thriving cricket community there. And the MCC used to come and tour there at one point. And that was fantastic. And I always liked that because you got Americans coming to watch. When there was a baseball strike, when I was playing up there, they came and filmed us because there was no sport to film otherwise. And I'm deeply ashamed. You'll get this, but the people watching TV didn't. I come thundering into bowl, and I was so excited to be on television that I pitched the ball about a third of the way down the wicket and bounced four times. The batsman was so taken aback by how bad it was that he missed it. And I clean bowled him. And, you know, the Americans thought that's what cricket was. So obviously they don't know.
That was the old no ball rule. It would have been a no ball now.
Yeah, it would be now.
I'm afraid he wouldn't have got the wicket.
Yeah, but back then I did. Yeah. And, you know, but it's true that, sad to say now, a lot of the great sports players of the West Indies are coming for the huge money in baseball and basketball and so forth. So I think you're right that it is sucking some of the life out of the West Indies, but they're still great, aren't they? They're still acquitting themselves.
Peter and I have played in Staten Island, and I've played, indeed we've played in a lot of, we had a coast-to-coast American tour, but we've played in Staten Island and Canarsie, and I've played in Prospect Park, Brooklyn, in the past. It used to be a big West Indian community, you know, sort of regular pickup game there.
Well, it is also the Indian and Pakistan communities, but it does tend to be more in the north than the east. I lived for 11 years doing capital defense work in New Orleans, and it was very hard in Louisiana to find anyone. I didn't get to play for 11 years, which was very sad.
Clive, but you've represented many people who love cricket, who are victims of injustice in one way or another, and some of them obviously facing execution. Earlier on in this podcast, we mooted the idea of an organisation to campaign for cricketers worldwide who are victims of some kind of oppression and injustice, and wondered if this might be the time to revive this idea. We wondered also, do you think the ICC should be more involved in human rights work on behalf of cricketers? What do you think of cricket's record, generally, the world of cricket, in fighting oppression and injustice?
Well, I think this, really. I don't know whether the ICC itself should do it, but I think it should certainly be done. It's a big mistake not to engage when there are human rights violations going on. You know, and I faced this in Guantanamo, where a lot of lawyers would take the position, we just shouldn't have anything to do with those people because it's so unjust that by taking part, what we're doing is giving them credibility. And I disagree with that, because on a very basic level, if you take that stance, you have one press release, which is the time that you refuse to take part. Whereas if, on the other hand, you engage, you can do a huge amount more. And whether it's done by the ICC itself or by an organization that we do in coordination doesn't make much difference to me, but it needs to be done. So, for example, when you look around the world at different places, you take Dubai right now and some of the things going on there, there are terrible human rights abuses going on in Dubai. And we can just be pious and say, oh, look, you're all evil. Or we can engage. And in several different forms of sport, I myself have been interested in the fact that some of the people, the rulers of Dubai, are just obsessed with horse racing. I grew up in Newmarket on Cheveley Park Stud, and I knew pretty much everyone in Newmarket. If you want to get those people who are running the Dubai and so forth to pay attention, then you start, you know, illustrating to the people of Newmarket at the races what's going on in Dubai, and you don't ignore it, you just sort of vaguely threaten it, if you will. And I think the same's true with cricket. You know, when you were talking about apartheid, if you just don't engage with South Africa, you know, I understand the morality of that, but I think you should go down there and raise it. And the same, you know, when you think about racism and you think about the Olympics, when the people did the Black Power salute at the Olympics, that's remembered to this day because they were at the Olympics and they were introducing injustice as a political issue at the Olympics. And I'm all for that. And when sports players use their incredible leverage to help move human rights forward, that's wonderful. And the side impact, obviously, is I get to go with them and we get to play cricket and Peter and I can have famous people playing with us and we can make a political point at the same time. And, you know, you need to enjoy yourself when you're doing human rights work. It's not all doom and gloom. It's actually a wonderful thing to do. So, yeah, I'm all for it. So when do we set this up, Richard? Well, let's have a very particular goal.
What goal should we have, would you say, Clive?
Well, I think you need to not try to do too much. You need to have very focused things. And I think we should be looking at Kashmir. We should be looking at Afghanistan. Those are places that we love and where we can do some good as well as enjoy ourselves. So that would be a great start. We'd be pushing at an open door with Imran Khan. We're pushing at an open door with the Taliban. So it's a really good place to start, and I don't think anyone's going to feel terribly threatened by that. You know, perhaps people will be a bit more threatened in Dubai, but then we'll do that next.
Dubai has become rather accidentally a cricket centre. It has hosted a lot of Pakistan's matches, and of course it's the headquarters now of the ICC, primarily for tax reasons. Clive, if we wanted to do some work for human rights in Dubai through cricket, how do you think we could set about it there?
Well, one of the issues in that part of the Middle East is the reason cricket has become big there is because of the pretty exploited expat community, huge numbers of people from Pakistan who were working there and who are victims of pretty dreadful discrimination. And indeed, at Reprieve, the charity I founded, we've helped to represent a large number of them, where they're being sentenced to death fairly willy-nilly for things that that they didn't do. So, you know, what you think about is how to use that platform in a way that's absolutely not subject to challenge. And we saw an example of this summer. When people took the knee in the matches between the West Indies and England, there are some places that would be immensely contentious. Dorset is one of them. So, you know, I've had a little Black Lives Matter thing going down here with my wife, and people get pretty annoyed about it for reasons that I understand but I don't agree with. But it's been great. And I thought that the fact that the teams did that provoked discussion. Prejudice is not based on someone being evil. It's based on people prejudging things because they don't know the facts. And when you start spreading those facts around, it becomes much more likely that they're going to do the right thing. And I've always viewed my job as looking at powerless people who are about, for example, to be executed by the state, where the state is sacrificing them to some mythological god of deterrence. And if we can just get the true facts of what's going on to people who are making those decisions, then the decisions start to change. And so, you know, you don't have to be offensive all the time. You want to have humor. But I'm sure we can come up with a good plan for how players who care can use symbols to raise issues that really matter in Dubai and elsewhere. But let's perhaps develop it on the really easy fronts, which are places where people are not going to be offended, and then we'll figure out the best way to deal with the more difficult fronts.
Clive, there's a lot to think about there. It's been wonderful talking to you. I'm sure you've got many more overs left in you, partly as a bowler and partly as a human rights campaigner. Thank you again for being with us.
And I'm looking forward very much for all of us regrouping in West Dorset to save the Broad Windsor Cricket Club next summer.
And we in Broad Windsor are looking forward to having you all, and some of your other listeners would love you to come down and play us too. Thanks so much.
It's such a pleasure having you on. Thank you. Such a fascinating conversation. It's goodbye from me, Peter Oborne, in Chiswick.
And it's goodbye from me, Richard Heller, in Southeast London.